This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, September 25th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. The First Serve Annual Tennis Tournament is October 4th through the 6th at Summerhill Athletic Club in Fayetteville. This Northwest Arkansas Free Health Center fundraiser supports medical, dental, and pharmaceutical services for the uninsured and those in need. Registration and more information available at nwafhc.org.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, highlights from a panel discussion on the University of Arkansas campus yesterday that addressed the complex issues surrounding the Trayvon Martin case. It's part of a new series organized by the Center for Multicultural and Diversity Education. Plus, a conversation with Edmar Castañeda, a jazz harpist who will perform at Walton Arts Center Friday night.
And Fayetteville prepares to celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month. Meredith Martin-Motes has the latest installment in her series of Arkansas book reviews and more.
But first, Mayflower residents expressing concerns over access to health care and government officials since the oil spill in March will get a chance to speak directly with a public official Thursday. Dr. William Mason, Preparedness and Emergency Response Branch Chief at the Arkansas Department of Health, will be at a town hall at Hendricks College for an hour-long question-and-answer session. Emily Lane with the Faulkner County Citizens Advisory Group says residents are likely to have an abundance of questions, including concern over air quality tests monitoring the carcinogen benzene.
The fact that they're using this minimum standard of 50 parts per billion to say, okay, this is safe, that's just not acceptable. When in most other places, 50 parts per billion would say, no, that's five times over safe levels. We don't need these people to be going back into their homes. So we want to know where that 50 parts per billion came from, why they're using it.
Lane says health screenings provided recently by the state after a push from Congressman Tim Griffin were insufficient because they relied on nurses and telemedicine instead of specialists, and the screenings were not promoted well in local media outlets.
The landlocked University of Arkansas in Fayetteville has received a sizable chunk of federal funding to create a maritime research and educational center. U.S. Senators Mark Pryor and John Bozeman and 3rd District Congressman Steve Womack announced yesterday the university has received $1.4 million in Department of Transportation funding for the center, which will expand the university's transportation research by improving maritime and multimodal logistics management, building infrastructure, and promoting livability and emergency management of coastal and river valley communities. The center will be established as part of the Department of Transportation's University Transit Center program, which also includes Jackson State University, Louisiana State University, and the University of New Orleans. The center at the U of A will be the first university transit center focused on maritime transportation research.
The annual Beaver Lake cleanup will take place this weekend, and the Army Corps of Engineers is looking for volunteers to help with the effort. Volunteers can check in by 8 a.m. Saturday at Prairie Creek, Hickory Creek, Rocky Branch, Lost Bridge North, or Damsite Lake Parks. The cleanup will last until 11 a.m., at which point lunch will be served to volunteers.
The City of Fayetteville will hold a town meeting at 7 o'clock Monday night at St. James Missionary Baptist Church on North Street. The meeting will include presentations by Mayor Lionel Jordan and officials from other city departments, after which time will be allowed for residents to ask questions of city leaders.
A new master plan for the University of Arkansas Fort Smith will be unveiled in the coming weeks. According to university officials, the plan has been under development for a year and will lay out future development of the campus for the next 15 to 20 years. The plan will address new buildings and the direction of campus growth and present design standards for future buildings. The new plan, which is an update of the college's 1990 master plan, will be unveiled during two input sessions at 3:30 and 5:30 p.m. October 9th at the campus's Smith Pendergraph Campus Center.
Earlier this month, it was announced Bentonville Central Park at Morningstar Elementary had been named a 2013 National Blue Ribbon School by the U.S. Department of Education. The award is given to public and private elementary, middle, and high schools where students achieve at high levels, where the achievement gap is narrowing, or both. Now, it has been announced, Immaculate Conception School in Fort Smith has also made the list, and according to thecitywire.com, it is the first elementary school in Fort Smith and the first Catholic school in the state to be named a Blue Ribbon School.
The Northwest Arkansas Leadership Council will host its second Northwest Arkansas Regional Volunteer Fair tomorrow from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Tyson Foods headquarters in Springdale. The event is designed to connect more than 50 regional nonprofit organizations with willing volunteers. The first such volunteer fair was held in May in Rogers by the Leadership Council, which was formed to help implement leadership-related goals of the Greater Northwest Arkansas Development Strategy, a five-year plan formed by the Northwest Arkansas Council and other regional stakeholders.
Most mostly clear tonight. Lows in the mid-50s in northwest Arkansas, lower 60s for the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, sunny, highs from 84 to 89. And for tomorrow night, mostly clear, lows from 59 to 64. Almost 20 months to the day that the names Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman became headlines and fodder for cable news networks, about 100 people gathered last night on the University of Arkansas campus to hear a panel discussion about the case, the trial, and the subsequent national discussions about the justice system, media, and race.
We're going to have a discussion about the Trayvon Martin case, and as you all know, it was one which really touched every corner of this country. And it really was one that also polarized this nation in many ways, or at least exposed the polarization that exists.
Charles Robinson, Vice Chancellor for Diversity and Community at the University of Arkansas, served as the moderator for the program, sponsored by the U of A's Center for Multicultural and Diversity Education. Five panel members offered analysis of the legal proceedings and how the press, especially cable television, covered the case. It was on February 26, 2012, when George Zimmerman fatally shot Trayvon Martin, an act Zimmerman said was in self-defense. Leon Jones, a criminal defense attorney, was one of last night's panelists. He told the audience the case, stripped of all sensational elements, was still an interesting matter to see unfold.
I think the thing that most intrigued me was the fact that we're not talking about celebrities. We're not talking about people with hundreds of millions of dollars. We're not talking about people that we see and read in the newspaper every day. We're talking about ordinary citizens who had a chance encounter one evening. And that's the thing that really intrigued me about this case. And I tried to pay attention to this case for that very reason. Not necessarily the black-white issue, but just the issue of these two individuals, citizens of the same community, when the facts came out, had a chance encounter. One of them ended up dead, and the other one ended up acquitted. And how did that happen?
Laurent Sakharov, an assistant professor of law at the university who specializes in criminal law and has worked as a defense attorney, used a few moments of last night's discussion to explain why many defense attorneys felt frustration with the trial that played out in front of a national audience.
The frustration of this case for a lot of defense lawyers, including me, is that defense lawyers, and especially public defenders, see firsthand the extraordinary racial bias in the criminal justice system, both how the police profile people, and then once people are arrested and charged. At every level, there are so many studies that show that there's a bias against black people as compared to white people. And what frustrates me about this case is that this case might not actually be the best example of that. And even though it's become a rallying cry, it becomes frustrating because it's hard to pinpoint well the racial bias.
Sakharov says there are many other places to see much clearer examples of racial bias, including litigation in New York City challenging the stop and frisk policy of the police there. He says a federal judge found clear racial bias after studying more than 4 million stop and frisk incidents during an 8-year period. Sakharov says a reading of that case offers what he calls concrete information about racial bias.
And again, going back to my frustration with the Zimmerman case, it really is a lot less clear that he really was. I mean, we have this preconception that he was racially profiling, but when you look at the 46 calls that he had made to the police before that, he calls in a lot of white people, and it's really hard to show there clearly that there was racial profiling in the ways that he had made calls to the police. So that's what's interesting about this case, but it's also what's frustrating about it.
Leon Jones, the other attorney on the panel, localized the issue of racial bias. He addressed the issue of bias in Northwest Arkansas.
I represent both black men and white men, and I can guarantee you that some of the deals that I've been able to cut for my white clients have been much easier to cut, have been a lot easier to process through than for my black clients, who, not saying that they were charged with the exact same thing, because you can't use that as the litmus test, But just from the process that has happened, from the stop, from the initial stop, all the way through the plea or the trial. And so if we look at that on a micro level here in Fayetteville, Arkansas, and then take it to a larger level in New York and Florida and all around the country, we'll see that there is a bias. There is a clear bias. And I deal with it every single day in my practice. And I think one of the issue that I have with it is that when people don't understand their rights, and so a lot of times the reason why that bias really comes out and is really prevalent is because the police understand that certain people don't understand their rights, or certain people don't have an opportunity to go and find out where they can find those rights. And so they just push them through the system just because they can.
Jones also offered an examination of the specifics regarding George Zimmerman's trial. He said the prosecution overreached when they filed second-degree murder charges. That meant they had to prove Zimmerman had what Florida law defines as a depraved mind.
And one of the things that I thought the defense did a great job with and very brilliantly brought out the fact that George Zimmerman didn't have a depraved mind, that it wasn't he didn't go there that night with the intent to kill not only Trayvon Martin, but anyone. And that he went there, he may have been a little overzealous in what he figured was his job as the neighborhood watch person, but he didn't have that requisite mens rea, as we call it in the law, or that mindset or that mental capacity to kill Trayvon Martin. And I think that's something that you know, we are emotional about the fact that this young black kid was killed, but in seeking justice, we also have to seek justice and not just persecute someone, mm-hmm. but we have to go to prosecute them under the appropriate law.
Last night's conversation also offered appraisals of how the press dealt with the case from start to finish. Corey Anderson, vice president of the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation, said from the beginning there was a racial aspect to the case, from the initial 911 call and beyond.
That it was actually the 911 operator that asked about the race of Trayvon. George Zimmerman didn't, they brought that forward. He didn't actually offer it. They asked him. And they didn't ask him, is he white, black, or Latino? They asked him, is he black or Latino? So even for the 911 officer, there was an assumption there that as George Zimmerman was talking about this person that was walking around this neighborhood, which is a diverse neighborhood, as a suspicious person, even the 911 officer assumed that it was either a black or a Latino person.
And thus, Anderson said he thought from the beginning there was a racial undercurrent in the press coverage, especially the coverage from national cable networks. He told last night's audience he thought the coverage of race in regards to the case was generally mishandled by the press.
Race is an issue that probably requires a scalpel to dissect it. And in general, media is a hatchet. They're using hatchets to do scalpel work. So in the sound bites that we got, whether they be on Fox or on CNN, I think both of them, I don't think either of them served the general public very well.
Patsy Watkins, a professor of journalism at the university, picked up the topic of cable news coverage. Cable channels, she said, are different than their older broadcast counterparts like NBC, CBS, and ABC. That difference, she explained, can have an influence on the style and the amount of coverage given to a certain topic.
Fox News is the leading cable news channel in terms of subscribers and in terms of revenue. Now, why is this? Because they have a very dedicated audience. This is an audience that stays with them all the time. Just as a quick, some quick figures here. During the wall-to-wall coverage of the trial this summer, people watched CNN, people watched Fox News. After the trial, CNN's viewership fell off 43%. Fox News viewership fell off 11%. They've got a dedicated audience.
The majority of that dedicated audience, she said, self-identifies as conservative. Watkins said last night that channel, like other cable channels, had a vested interest in keeping viewers coming back to watch.
Fox News has a very clear Republican conservative line here, and it is in their best interest to keep the audience that they have and to give that audience what that audience expects and wants. That determines the kind of coverage that they have. So they're playing to that side of this political spectrum. CNN has not managed to find a way to create a niche for itself yet. They're somewhat liberal. MSNBC has far outpaced them in being liberal. So they're not really sure where they are yet. So we have a semi-liberal, semi-democratic cable news outlet versus a very die-hard Republican outlet. I think that brings it to a political division, a political level.
The entire panel agreed that the coverage and reaction across the board was a stunning example of a country still wrestling with race and involved in a wide political divide. Ron Harris, another panelist participating last night, is the founder and president of the organization A Level Up that helps at-risk youth. He said the coverage of the case merely mimicked what already exists.
Whether it was sloppy reporting on all points, whether the viewership was the same, it was giving edubites of information and leaving the viewer to come to a summary. When you do that, regardless of whether you're CNN or Fox, the person is always going to lead to the next bad thing. If you say the word race, are we going to think good or are we going to think bad? Whether it's CNN or Fox, you're going to always think toward the weeds. That's just my summary as I look at television and not that, but or listen to other mediums. But I think this incident, from a very large standpoint, revealed and just let out of the box how people feel anyway. And so it gave people an opportunity to share and to see and for information to be exposed of what's already there. Mm-hmm. So whether it's a liberal bias or a conservative bias, I think it's always in the interest of those people that are buying information, but it's also the viewership of people, that even the people that are here today. There's an interest, and our responsibility is to really zero in on the specifics, not just the demographics of people, but it's the interest of the general people and the general populace of why people were incensed about race in general.
Much of the final third of the discussion centered on the national dialogue beyond the circumstances surrounding the Trayvon Martin shooting, about race. Toward the end, there was this exchange after the moderator, Charles Robinson, asked for comments regarding President Obama's remarks when talking about the Trayvon Martin case. In this exchange, we'll hear from Laurent Sokharov, an assistant professor of law at the University of Arkansas, and Corey Anderson, vice president of the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation.
One quick thing I'll add that now that you're talking about it, that I really liked about his speech was that he not only humanized a black person, but a youth. So he talked about himself as a 17-year-old and how, you know, he would hear the clicks of the doors of people locking their car doors. And it was such a vivid image, but it was like, President Barack Obama was once a 17-year-old, and he wasn't a thug. He was, you know, it's so easy to see him, the tall and lanky and probably really nerdy and studying a lot. And it really made us remember that part of the stereotype and part of the pernicious stereotype isn't just race, it's also youth. Like, we just have this idea of someone of that age being, you know, what they used to call super predators. They finally got rid of that term, but I thought that was really good.
And you all may not invite me back up here, so I'm sorry, but...
No, go ahead.
even this issue, and I agree with you. What he did, what his statement did, was he humanized Trayvon. The question, I think, for all of us to grapple with was, why did he have to, right?
Yeah.
Like, why was it necessary for the president, I mean, the leader of the free world, to stand up and say that, to bring this humanity? Because I you're absolutely right. And then, but if you juxtapose it, and again, I think we have to sort of scratch at these things a little bit, but if you juxtapose it, you know, there are certain people that you don't have to humanize. Again, if we're talking about the media, when the young teenage white girl with blonde hair goes missing, it's automatically, everybody feels, including us, right? I mean, including people of all hues and shapes and sizes, we feel and we want to find her and we want to know what happened. And nobody has to take the step to humanize that person. But for a young black man, the president of the United States has to stand up in order for people to move forward and see that. And I think that's really the question, again, that's at the root of, I think, what we're struggling with here.
Did you notice who the last witness of the defense was in the Trayvon Martin case?
I didn't.
A young blonde woman who had been burglarized, totally unrelated, well, not totally, but in that same area. So that, I mean, that was one of the more racial aspects of the trial. I only say that because it does tie into these paradigms.
And I should say also, you know, we're talking here in broad generalizations, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not to sort of cast aspersions on anybody, but I think if we're going to get underneath, I think, yep, some of this stuff, I think we just have to be just a little bit more transparent.
Last night's panel discussion about the Trayvon Martin case was sponsored by the Center for Multicultural and Diversity Education at the University of Arkansas and was held on the University of Arkansas campus. This is Ozarks at Large. It is Wednesday, September 25th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Becca Martin-Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. You're on.
I'm psychic. I have on a turban, and I'm holding something up to my forehead.
Like
Johnny Carson.
Right.
And I got the reference.
Okay.
Oh, good girl.
I saw a look. I got the reference.
Good
Thank
girl.
You.
Because I sense a theme, a trend.
Uh-huh.
We just got over Bikes and Songs.
Yes.
We talked yesterday about Nine Inch Nails being on tour.
Yes.
And today I'm going to tell you that Seven Dust is going to be at the Arkansas-Oklahoma State Fair.
They are loud as well.
Yes, they are. Uh-huh. So that's the trend. This is part of some really eclectic music at the fair. They have country. Mm-hmm. They have Seven Dust, which I consider metal.
Yeah.
I think in the industry they're called loud rock.
Really?
Yeah, I think that's what they're...
Well, I'm going to go with metal. Their recent CD is called Black Out the Sun. Mm-hmm. That's a metal title. They also have Bull Riding and Demolition Derby.
Love Demolition Derby.
So you should go to the fair. Seven Dust plays at 8 o'clock Friday, and they've moved the shows this year into Hugh Harden Arena at K. Rogers Park. Admission to the headline entertainment, all of it, is free with paid gate admission. $7 for adults and $4 for children 12 and younger. They also have, of course, a midway and all of the regular fair stuff. You can find out more at ArkansasOklahomaFair.com.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Fayetteville-based trash can bandits create a raucous upbeat sound filled out with clarinet, banjo, mandolin, and trumpet. They have a new release coming out called The Righteous and the Wicked. Stream it in its entirety right now on our blog. That's KUAF.com/mixdown.
This is Ozarks at Large. National Hispanic Heritage Month began September 15th, and this year, Fayetteville will mark the occasion with the inaugural Northwest Arkansas Hispanic Heritage Festival and Health Fair, September 27th and 28th, at the Washington County Fairgrounds. The observation started in 1968 as Hispanic Heritage Week under President Lyndon B. Johnson, and it was expanded to a month by President Ronald Reagan in 1988. The 30-day period lasts from September 15th to October 15th. September 15th is significant because it marks the anniversary of independence for Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and Nicaragua. Mexico and Chile celebrate their Independence Day September 16th and 18th, respectively. And October 12th, which is Columbus Day or Dia de la Raza, also falls within the 30-day period. Patty Kimbrough is the event coordinator for this year's festival, which she says was the brainchild of Greg Fess, Univision Arkansas CEO, and Steve Clark, Fayetteville Chamber of Commerce President and CEO. Kimbrough says they have been planning the event since last December, and they've received advice from organizers of Bikes, Blues, and Barbecue.
We sit down and visited about it, and they're just like, this is a wonderful idea, because, you know, it's very much like what we encountered when we started Bikes and Blues. It's like, Dixon Street merchants didn't want bikers, so-called bikers, in their businesses. And then, you know, slowly over time with that, you know, learning another culture, which not to say that bikers are a different culture, but in ways they are. They're different. They have a different stereotype probably, which is not good. This is what we hope to accomplish, is to delineate that stereotype, if you will. But this is such a, to me, such an exciting culture that, you know, has such a great zest for life and love and music and fun. And I think it's just an absolute perfect fit, because for Fayetteville, we do too have a large, you know, Hispanic population here. And we want that population that's so vital to our community and the diversity that makes Fayetteville great to feel welcome and to feel like, you know, Fayetteville does embrace their culture and we want to learn more about it. And I think that's the only way we'll, you know, coincide peacefully going forward. I think it's just a good fit all the way around. It's a good thing to do. It's the right thing to do.
Kimbrough explains each year the festival will highlight a different Latin American country. This year's country is Panama, so Ricardo Martinelli, the president of Panama and a University of Arkansas graduate, will be on hand to kick off the event Friday afternoon. In addition to the health fair on Saturday, which will feature free screenings, the festival will also have a petting zoo, car show, craft display, tamale contest, and live music. Musical acts include local as well as out-of-state performers. The lineup includes Andre El Chef, Papa Rap, Los Reyes de la Calle, and the Kansas City-based band Making Movies. In addition to the scheduled musical acts Friday evening, you may also hear salsa music at the festival as part of the salsa dancing lessons or the salsa dancing competition. Aura King, owner of Dance King Productions, will be helping teach participants how to dance the salsa. She describes it as a tropical dance that, as the name implies, is a bit of a mix.
Right now, it's kind of, you know, it's being a fight of where it's from because of a mix. But from we as a dancer, what we understand, it definitely started here in the United States, in New York. You know, that people from Cuba and, you know, that immigrate here was a started, you know, the rhythm, the style, from a mix of like the mambo and the cha-cha, you know. So it's mainly Latin dance, okay? And just like we work a lot actually in what we call Latin motion, you know, the wiggling of the hips, and that is actually one of the characteristics too in the salsa. Yes, it's a very easy dance to learn, you know, and all that we ask is, you know, just don't think so much in what you're doing, just to feel it.
King is a professional dancer, and she recalls her first performance was at school in El Salvador at the age of 3. While visiting her family here in the States, King met her husband, who now helps her manage Dance King Productions. She says the business has been open for about 7 years, but she has been teaching dance for almost 19 years.
Every time I hear music, my body just kind of starts moving, you know, and I don't know. I definitely discover as a really, really young age that I really loved it. My passion, it became stronger and stronger, and I still keep it, and I think I will die with this passion, you know?
The dance lessons are free, and the cost to participate in the salsa competition is $10 per person. Aura King says judges look for a number of things, including how much fun the dancers are having.
Because we don't want to see anybody that it has, you can see that it has the pressure just because you want to win, okay? You have to be, definitely enjoy it, definitely a connection with your partner. Okay, the connection is going to bring you to how well you're being, as a guy, being able to lead, and how well, as a girl, you're being able to follow. We're going to check, of course, how fancy you can get, you know, and but those are going to be the main things that we're going to see. And, of course, always, like we say when we teach, the rule number one, if you're being able to keep the rule number one, that's number one, and it's the rhythm. if you're being able to keep up with the rhythm, then the rest, it would come easier.
The inaugural Northwest Arkansas Hispanic Heritage Festival and Health Fair will take place this Friday and Saturday at the Washington County Fairgrounds. Patty Kimbrough, event coordinator for the festival, says money raised from the event will go to scholarships provided through Univision Arkansas and support leadership programs in Northwest Arkansas. Festivities begin at 3 Friday afternoon and 10 Saturday morning. Admission is $5 for adults and $1 for children 12 and younger each day. More information is available at facebook.com/NWAHHFestival.
As we mentioned, the festival will continue highlighting a different Latin American country each year. Eventually, the festival will shine a light on the culture of Colombia, which is the birthplace of the first performer in this year's Walton Art Center's jazz series.
Edmar Castañeda, who will perform with his quartet Friday night, was born in Bogotá, the capital city of Colombia. The jazz harpist recently spoke by phone with Robert Ginsberg, host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz. During the conversation, Robert talked with Edmar about being born into a musical family. In addition to composing, singing, and teaching, Edmar's father also plays the harp.
He's a harpist and a piano player, so I got a lot of influence from him, Pavelito Castañeda. Yes, I started dancing folk music from Colombia, from one part of Colombia when I was 7 years old. And then when I moved, and then at 13, I had a chance to learn a little bit of the harp, you know. I pretty much learned the harp myself. But I had a little bit teacher in Colombia that gave me some tips to start, you know, when I was 13.
I think we should maybe explain that the Colombian harp is a traditional instrument, a folkloric instrument of this region of Colombia and Venezuela. But that harp is a much lighter and smaller harp than what people in this country think of as a symphonic harp.
The pedal harp usually is the more popular or like people know, you know, orchestra harp. And this one in South America, we have different kinds of harp. We have one in Colombia and Venezuela. We share the same harp. And then Veracruz, Mexico, and then Paraguay, you know, different size, different way of playing it. And everybody, you know, a lot of people play them. That's like the main instrument of the music in that region.
You moved to New York City, I believe, when you were 16 years old. And was that when jazz started to become an influence in the music you were listening to?
Yes. When I was in Colombia, I never listened to jazz. I mean, when I came to New York, you know, I went to high school after 2 days arriving. And the first thing I heard was in a rehearsal in high school of a big band playing the Take the Agent by Duke Ellington. And I was like, wow, man, I really want to play that, you know. I was like, what is this music, you know? And the thing is that in traditional folk music, the one that I play on the harp, you improvise a lot. So I got a big connection with the jazz, too. I mean, to play jazz, you need to feel it, you know. You need to play with a big band, with a quartet, or something just to feel it, you know, and then you learn the theory and stuff. But for the harp, it's just classical music, you know, there's no jazz. So it was a great opportunity to feel the jazz and then learn it and then pass it to the harp, you know, whatever I could, you know, transcribe for the harp.
When you were in college, you had a gig every day at a restaurant playing solo harp, and I imagine that was probably a great testing ground for you developing a style.
Yes, I mean, that was my school, that gig at the restaurant, you know, Maison Olé. It was like every day, you know, I came from all the information I was getting in the college and then go at night and try to incorporate on the harp, you know, and jamming, because it was a solo harp, so solo gig. It was good because it forced me to play all the parts and, you know, just jam. It was really fun, you know. I create pretty much this style in that restaurant.
They were willing to let you play what you wanted to play.
Yeah, anything. They were really happy with.
And, you know, a lot of people that hear your music, which is this become this hybrid of all these styles, make the comparison between, well, they might say, this reminds me of flamenco music. I think that's pretty obvious as well.
Yes, actually, the harp, when I came the first time to South America and to Colombia, as well, I came from the Spanish people, you know, from, and it's very Andalus, like Andalusia, like flamenco sound, by church it came. So it has that sound, too, and then each part of the country to the harp, and then just develop a different way of playing it, like Paraguay took it, you know, they started playing like there. But it came from the Spanish people, you know.
There's something about the forcefulness, you know, the attack on the instrument, too, that shares that.
Yeah, very flamenco, very percussive.
I meet South American musicians who have kind of turned their attention to jazz, but typically a lot of them were listening to it when they were very young. Either somebody in their family had, you know, blues and big band and jazz music.
Yeah.
So in a way, you were a little more removed from that. But
yeah, it was only folk music, you know.
But still, you heard a connection when you connected.
Yeah, the first time when I heard that Charlie Parker, and I was like, what is that? I couldn't understand, you know, everything, all the chords, all the changes was so fast for me. And I was like, really, I just want to know this. And I started, you know, from there, you know.
In your music and in your playing, you really establish a groove.
Yeah, for me, a groove is very important. And I treat the harp like as a two or three instruments playing at the same time, you know. Like left hand just playing like bass groups, you know, force myself to groove. And the right hand, very independent, just to improvise and play melodies and chords, you know, at the same time. That's the tricky part, you know.
To hear you perform, it seems as though there's nothing you can't do. But there are some limitations to this instrument, aren't there, in terms of how
yes,
it's tuned?
Yes, of course. It's a very limited instrument, you know. Like to play like a traditional jazz is very difficult because it's a titanic instrument. So you have to tune in keys and different modes and stuff, but you cannot modulate, you know, as comfortable as a piano or as a guitar, you know. So it's very limited, but you know, actually, that makes more special the instrument because you find other ways to approach, you know, to play it.
In the six or seven years since you released your first CD, Cuarto de Colores, your career has really taken off. I applaud your success. And in that short period of time, you've played with people like Paquito de Rivera and Dave Samuels and Miguel Zinón, Gonzalo Rubalcaba, John Scofield. All of them are really jazz musicians who embrace influences that are taking the music to new places. Are you glad to be a part of that give and take in terms of keeping jazz alive and changing?
Of course, yes. You know, it's just to share, you know. But I think that only happens here in the States, you know. It's great to share with all the musicians in the city and be free and share without any you know, any problem. It's amazing. It just keep growing up and making new music.
When you perform this Friday at the Walton Arts Center, you're going to be performing with your drummer, Dave Silliman, and also with a very fine saxophonist, Shlomi Cohen.
This guy gives a great sound, you know. He plays the soprano sax, but he's from Israel, and he brings all that, you know, all that vibe from there, and it's amazing. It's great. I think I always love to change musicians because they always bring something new to the table, you know.
You know, I was listening to a track off of one of your CDs, Madrugada de Azul. I think is what
it was. Yeah, with Paquito.
Yes, with Paquito on clarinet. And it has, there is sort of, it's, it has a Latin feel, but there's also this tinge of Middle Eastern music as well to my ear.
Yeah, a little bit of that, yeah.
So I'm guessing that's what you're saying. Shlomi brings some of that to the music.
Yeah, you have to see this guy. He's really, he's a great, the passion and the tone that he brings is very, brings different colors to the trio and passion, you know, it's great.
That was Robert Ginsberg, host of KUAF Shades of Jazz, speaking to Edmar Castañeda. The Edmar Castañeda Quartet will perform at 7 and 9 Friday night at Walton Art Center. More information is available at waltonartcenter.org.
And you can hear Robert on Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday night at 10 on KUAF.
Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs and research through a collective voice. The AMP Arkansas Music Pavilion presents ZZ Top Friday, October 4th. This classic rock trio will perform a span of hits dating back 40 years. Tickets and more information are available at amptickets.com or 443-5600.
And speaking of the AMP, due to unavoidable circumstances, Queens of the Stone Age canceling its show at the AMP that was going to take place on October 8th. Not going to happen. All tickets will be refunded in full. No further action required by ticket buyers to receive the refund. At this time, best efforts are being made to reschedule the show. Officials apologize for the inconvenience.
But the show tonight is still on. As far as I know, Vampire Weekend is still going to be there tonight.
Yes.
So I've heard nothing about that.
Yes. Vampire Weekend's happening.
Okay. Clearing that up.
Yes.
Looking at other activities happening this week, the Arkansas Union is turning 40. The original Arkansas Union building opened in 1973. And Thursday, tenants of the union will host Union Day with the celebratory theme Union Back 40. I like that. Activities include free food, union history, giveaways, and more. And you can follow at Arkansas Union on Instagram and Twitter to find out more.
I lived off campus my entire college career, and so the Arkansas Union was, I spent a sizable part of my life in the Arkansas Union. Scrambled eggs and Dr. Pepper for breakfast when I was in college.
Oh, wow.
Not advised.
Oh, wow.
After its hour-long season premiere garnered 11.8 million viewers, Duck Dynasty has earned the title of the number one nonfiction telecast in cable history.
I think I was accidentally one of those viewers.
I was
sitting with my boyfriend and we were just kind of flipping channels and just happened to be on. And I didn't realize it was the premiere and that it was that big.
Well, next month, Willie, Uncle Cy, and other members of the Duck Dynasty Robertson family will be in Northwest Arkansas as part of an event that is produced by Cox Communications. It's scheduled to begin at 3 October 20th at Arvest Ballpark. Live music scheduled at 5. The Robertson schedule will make their presentation at 6. It will include vendor booths and a kids area. Tickets for the event are on sale starting at $28. Cox Communications also will be giving away a limited number of tickets at local stores. More information at fieldofducks.com.
Yes, you can go to actually the Northwest Arkansas Naturals site, nwanaturals.com, and get the tickets now. And for more information about when Cox is giving away, because there's certain days at certain locations.
Okay.
And I think there's maybe like 120 at each of the locations. And that's, you can find out those dates and those locations at fieldofducks.com.
And they make duck calls, correct?
I think so. That's my understanding.
Okay.
That's my understanding. The few episodes I've seen, I feel like they don't talk a lot about the actual
duck. Yeah, that's
duck
the thing.
Calls.
I think that's how they, that's what their business is about.
I think that's their business, but there's always other things happening.
Zaniness ensues.
Ensues. Okay. That's a really good way to put it.
Okay.
So a really good way to put it. So hunting kind of sports-ish, there's some other sports news we have for people.
Oh, yeah. The University of Arkansas women's golf team is now 8th in the latest Golf World National Golf Association poll. The Razorbacks have two events under the belt this season, opening with a 6th-place showing at the Dale McNamara NCAA Preview, and they won the Mercedes-Benz Collegiate in Knoxville, Tennessee last week. Congratulations.
This is Ozarks at Large. During the past few months, we've had an ongoing series which highlights books from the past that try to explore what it means to call Arkansas home. This series is about uncovering or rediscovering some books that can shed light on the complexities of our own state and the lives of the people who create it. Meredith Martin Motes has the latest installment in our series.
Created in 1965, the VISTA program was part of President Johnson's War on Poverty and the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964. This national legislation sought to provide lasting and locally based solutions to struggling communities. Marvin Schwartz's 1988 publication, In Service to America, A History of VISTA in Arkansas, 1965 to 1985, is an in-depth look at the difficulties, successes, and lasting legacy of the diversity of VISTA programs throughout the state. Drawing from interviews with VISTA workers from Fayetteville to Marianna, the book explores what Bill Clinton calls in the preface, quote, an ingenious concept which taught us about the importance and power of people building from within, end quote. Depending on where you stood on the issues, the early VISTA programs were welcomed in impoverished communities or were quickly driven out by the wealthier citizens. Even today, these initiatives read as some of the most radical to ever take place in the state. Operating much like a domestic version of the Peace Corps, volunteers in the VISTA program received a subsistence wage and lived in economically poor areas where they worked in partnership with community members to generate economic initiatives and aid residents in gaining access to health care, housing, and adequate food. Writing in the introduction, author Marvin Schwartz explains, quote, this was part of the plan, to have the anti-poverty change agents on the same economic level as the people being served, living among them and seeing the world from their perspective, end quote. VISTA's worked throughout the South, but Arkansas in particular is known for its highly successful VISTA programs, including the Lee County Cooperative Medical Clinic in Marianna, which remains an active organization in East Arkansas. The Arkansas River Valley Area Council, known locally as ARVAC, is a community action agency based in Dardanelle, and until 1986 was the nation's oldest VISTA sponsor. ARVAC is perhaps best known for the creation of the Rural Folk Crafts Co-op. In operation until the early 1990s, this Ozark-centered collective encompassed a network of rural quilters, white oak basket makers, seamstresses, and other artisans who sold their traditional wares to earn a living for their families. One of the strengths of Schwartz's book is the way in which he hones in on the particulars of each region. Take, for example, his profile of ARVAC. Still in existence, ARVAC is often held up as an example of VISTA program's long-term success. In 1960, when the program began, approximately 40% of the population in the River Valley was living below the poverty line. Illiteracy, inadequate housing, disease, and unemployment were rampant. As a VISTA organization, ARVAC formed programs such as the Housing Development Corporation, an organization utilizing the rural tradition of barn raising to help low-income families secure homes, and Counseling Associates, formerly known as the Community Mental Health Program. Each of these programs were nurtured under the ARVAC banner, but eventually became self-sufficient, a key goal of the VISTA program. In discussing the intricacies of each region, Schwartz uncovers the stories of individual volunteers, like Myrtle Kress, who worked in rural Ola, and Betty Burnett, who organized a housing co-op in Dardanelle. While some of the initiatives may sound familiar to Arkansans today, others never came to fruition. They were temporary, often deemed too controversial, and collapsed under pressure and lack of resources. In 1969, for example, three groups in the Mississippi County towns of Birdsong, Burdett, and Osceola came together to create the United People's Cooperative. They sought to attack the problems of poverty and succeeded in creating buying clubs and purchased acres of land for cultivation. The co-op lasted for 5 years before being squelched by members of the white business community. In the early days, VISTA brought in volunteers from around the nation. Throughout the book, these former volunteers referred to their early perspectives as naive at best. In many cases, the volunteers came from California or cities in the Northeast and had little understanding of the complexities of poverty in Arkansas and the layers of racism that existed. In the later years, the VISTA organization became more focused on long-term, locally-based volunteers who shared the radical approach of the national volunteers but had deep ties to the community. In the best of situations, outside and local volunteers could work together. Local volunteer Melvin Brown explained it this way, quote, the national volunteers had the know-how. I knew where people were. I could tell them in which yard the dog would bite and in which yard the dog would just look at you, end quote.
In many cases, the presence of VISTA volunteers in communities led to huge controversy, such as the Bradley County Community Action Cooperative, where on New Year's Eve in 1968, four national white volunteers were arrested by city police for having African-American guests in their home where a dance was taking place. It was the first integrated party in the county, Schwartz explains, and the volunteers were arrested for, quote, race mixing. In later years, the number of African-American volunteers increased, and Schwartz's book includes interviews with Ollie Neal, who helped the Lee Cooperative Medical Clinic blossom, and Bobby Morgan of Fayetteville, who shared stories of his time in the Tin Cup community. The book isn't some kind of feel-good narrative of regional solutions to poverty. Rather, it's a book that explores the complexity of some of the state's earliest organizing initiatives, and, in so doing, wrestles with that never-ending question of how fundamental change occurs, from the inside, the outside, or an inspired and long-term wedding of the two. It's sobering, these explorations of initiatives that were often targeted as, quote, socialist experiments and quickly run out of town. But there's long-term success stories, too. Perhaps what's most valuable about the book for the modern reader is the window it offers into Arkansas history and how anti-poverty workers approach the problems that, in many cases, still plague our state today. This 1988 publication, In Service to America, provides us with much to consider, especially for community workers developing strategies to address the needs of the present day and plan for a stronger and more collective future. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Meredith Martin-Motes.
Meredith Martin-Motes is a regular contributor to Ozarks at Large, and she's director of the McElroy House, an organization for cultural resources and community action. And you can read her work at her blog, boileddownjuice.com.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, trading retirement homes for part-time work. Some seniors are competing for jobs flipping burgers.
Trying to get an employer to look at it age-free, if you would. 77 is not as old as you think. At least I don't think so now.
A new generation of seniors that can't stop working. Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. In celebration of its 50th anniversary, the Elizabeth Richardson Center welcomes Jerry Jewell, actress and disability advocate, to the Fayetteville High School Performing Arts Center October 10th at 7 p.m. Jerry received worldwide recognition as the first person with a disability to be cast in a primetime television series. Tickets and more information are available at 872-1800 or ercinc.org.
The Facts of Life.
Which one was she?
Well, she was...
Oh, right.
I think it was Facts of Life that she was
I think you're right.
On.
I think yeah. You're right.
Let's see. This is KUAF, 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Hawksbill Craig.
Hawksbill Craig? Craig or Crag?
Crag. Thank you. Crag, yes. Not a town, but a place.
It
where
is a
lot
place.
Of us have been and almost everyone has seen.
I haven't been.
You have not been?
I've never been. When I was out at Horseshoe Canyon a few weeks ago, I had some friends go do that hike, but I had to get back for rehearsals, so I did not get to go.
Well, this will shock you, but when I have gone with friends, I get there, and the first thing is I admire its beauty, and then instantly I get worried because I think people are getting too close to the edge.
Of course.
So if you go, admire the beauty, but don't get too
but
close to the
safe.
Edge.
But be safe.
Please.
Okay. Okay. I can... I will do my best.
That's all I ask. I'm not, and not just you, anyone who goes.
Of course.
Because there are not fences there.
No, that would be less beautiful.
Right. But use common sense.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
Your public service announcement of the day.
I like it.
Vampire Weekend in concert tonight.
At the Amp.
Just was a review this past weekend in the New York Times of their show at the Barclay Center in Brooklyn.
Good review?
Fairly positive. Fairly positive.
Excellent. Yes. I'm excited about it. I really am. I'm not, like, super familiar with all the songs. I'm familiar enough. Mm-hmm. And I was telling my mom this morning, as she asked who this was, I said, well, if you don't know them, you do know them, because you've probably heard their music on commercials.
Right. And they do a great cover of I'm Going Down by Bruce Springsteen that was used at the end of an episode of Girls on HBO.
I don't know any of that.
Okay.
I haven't seen Girls, and I don't know the Bruce Springsteen song, of course. So, you know. Anyways.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Have a good Wednesday.